inch of snow possible, and for Friday, patchy blowing snow in the morning, highs 19 to 28, and blustery northwest wind. Colder by Saturday with highs near zero.
Hello, I'm Neil Kuxall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Something is rotten for the state of Denmark. Nothing was resolved in today's meeting between Danish, Greenlandic and American officials. And Donald Trump still seems hell-bent on taking possession of Greenland, which leaves Denmark in an extremely awkward position.
And putting the teat in Bon Appetit, scientists have discovered that certain sea lions never stop visiting their mothers to get topped up on mother's milk. And I apologize in advance for telling you that the scientists call these freeloading sea lions super sucklers.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on KAXC. We'll also hear the set list, some live music to check out this weekend. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Let's sample our album of the week. It's called Secret Love by the band Dry Cleaning, a British rock band from London releasing their third full-length album. The band is known for vocalist Florence Shaw's deadpan spoken word delivery and unconventional lyrics over prominent bass lines and post-funk grooves. On this album, they expand their sound a bit to include elements of folk rock and occasional singing from Shaw. You can let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. The song we're going to hear this evening from Dry Cleaning is called Cruise Ship Designer.
I'm a cruise ship designer. I'm striking while the iron is hot. I'm making the most of a bad situation. Cruises are big business. I don't personally like them, but I need to serve a useful purpose. I desire very much a place in society. So designing cruise ships is my pastime and my living and my challenge. Designing cruises is for me a privilege and a lesson. Need to do it all the time.
Need to do it all the time.
Cruise ship designer. Striking while the iron is hot.
Striking while the iron is hot.
Making the most of a bad situation. It's for a powerful mind, and I design hotels that cause controversy. But I'm semi-anonymous, climbing ladders. I'm not an ambitious man. I believe in design. While the iron's hot, making the most.
Striking while the iron is hot.
Of a bad situation, it's a powerful boat for a powerful mind.
This is the set list on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at four shows Thursday through Saturday, January 15th through the 17th in Aiken, Grand Rapids, and Park Rapids. First up, Rich Madsen and Jermaine Gemberling are playing a duo show at Sampaguita in Aiken Thursday at 6 o'clock. The Musical and Life Partners are getting ready to release another Rich Madsen and the North Stars album next month. And their duo shows are largely acoustic affairs, digging into their deep catalog of songs. It's Rich and Jermaine this Thursday at Sampaguita in Aiken. We're sticking in Aiken for Charlie Parr at the Ripple Center Friday at 6 p.m. The beloved folk blues artist sold out the venue the last time he visited and will be sure to draw a large crowd again. His most recent release was a novel called Five last year. Opening the show are Duluth-based Water Cats, who blend French pop and folk. Charlie Parr at the Ripple Center this Friday. Also Friday night, Americana and folk singer-songwriter Charlie Wagner is playing at Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids at 7 p.m. Wagner released the Finding Home album last year with an accompanying multimedia book. And after this show, we'll have a book tour throughout northern Minnesota. It's Charlie Wagner this Friday night at Rapids Brewing. Finally, Corey Medina and Brothers are playing the Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids Saturday night at 7 p.m. The Medina-led Electric Blues Quartet are rounded out by Gary Brusty on bass, Brock Bolio on second guitar, and Eric Sundin on drums. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Legault of Legault, Quebec's premier resigned abruptly today. We'll find out what that means for the upcoming provincial election and the prospect of yet another Parti Québécois-initiated referendum on independence.
Stepping up by stepping down. Several top prosecutors resign over the U.S. Justice Department's refusal to investigate the ICE agent who killed Rene Good. We'll hear from a veteran of the department who quit last year to apply pressure from the outside.
Stepping up by sitting down, months before Rosa Parks and at just 15 years old, the late Claudette Colvin refused to give up her seat on a segregated bus. A close friend honors a quiet hero of the civil rights movement.
Treasured Island. Today's big White House meeting does not seem to have diminished Donald Trump's troubling yearning for Greenland, but the government of Denmark is still very keen on dissuading the president.
Kitchen stink drama. Health inspectors give a Michelin-starred restaurant in Wales a one-star rating for hygiene, but the chef says the grossness is grossly exaggerated.
And teat-lipped. A biologist introduces us to the sea lions in the Galapagos Islands known as super sucklers, which, as you may have already figured out, are called that because they milk their mothers for all they're worth. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that takes you on an uncomfortable stroll down Mammary Lane. We obviously can't predict the result of the next provincial election in Quebec, but as of today, we can tell you one thing. The winner won't be François Legault.
Je vois bien qu'actuellement, beaucoup de Québécois souhaitent d'abord du changement, puis entre autres, un changement de premier ministre.
The Quebec premier and leader of the Coalition Avenir Québec announcing his resignation this morning. Speaking to reporters, Mr. Legault said he will stay on as party leader until his replacement is chosen, but will not be running in the next election. That's scheduled for no later than October 5th, and recent polls had suggested the outgoing premier's party was headed for certain defeat. Philippe J. Fournier is the editor-in-chief of the polling website 338 Canada and a contributing writer to The Walrus. We reached him today in Montreal.
Philippe, in your column just this morning, before the resignation, you wrote that it might be time for Legault to take, as you put it, his walk in the snow, borrowing that term, of course, from former Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Did you think Legault would take that advice so quickly?
Well, not so quickly. But if somebody looked coldly just at the numbers and not at the human element, anybody analyzing these numbers for the CAQ and for François Legault for the past year and a half would have come to the same conclusion that his time was done. And not only was his time done, but his party was facing nothing less than a wipe out the map if he was going to stay. We have several polls from several pollsters, and also I do seat projections, and my current seat projection for the CAQ is low single digits in seats with the possibility of having absolutely zero seats for the CAQ. So François Legault was adamant before Christmas mm-hmm. that he was going to stay on, that he was going to fight.
He told our colleagues that. Yeah, he said we're going to win.
Absolutely. And he made also many Rocky analogies that he was going to fight. Yeah. But perhaps that the numbers piled up and he saw the writing on the wall that if he wants his party to survive past him, he had to go.
And it's remarkable given what's been happening with the Liberals as well. They lost their leader. There's controversy there. What story were the polls telling?
Well, the latest poll that we published this morning in the Walrus and L'Actualité said that the provincial Liberals in Quebec seem to be doing okay now that Monsieur Rodriguez is gone. They're not in a position to take power or even be competitive to take power, but they're in a position to at least have a respectable result if things hold, of course. The Parti Québécois is still leading and leading handily among francophone voters, but it's interesting that in the data, we see that every party has vulnerabilities, including the Parti Québécois. And I think this is what Monsieur Legault was hanging his hat on, that mm-hmm. saying that other parties have problems, it's not only me. But his numbers were the worst of the lot, and I think this decision today could perhaps save his party.
And change the whole game entirely?
Well, it would be very unwise for me to predict a huge change, but it is at least now possible. Now, just to give you a picture, the poll this morning, we ask, this is a tracking that we do, we ask, do you have a favorable or unfavorable view of, and then we name all the leaders. Monsieur Legault had 12% favorable and 75% unfavorable. These numbers are without precedent. Even Monsieur Trudeau, the Prime Minister last year, when he resigned, he did not have that numbers that bad. And so Monsieur Legault found himself in a hole that was impossible to climb out of.
So do you think that what happened with Trudeau and now Prime Minister Mark Carney, how much did that the Mark Carney factor and what happened federally inform this decision, do you think?
Well, I mean, the situations are incredibly different, but this script that a leader stays a little too long, becomes unpopular, leaves, and then is replaced, usually we know how that script ends. It ends in the party losing power. It's just that 1 year ago, we saw that script completely reversed with Mark Carney. If we look at precedent, the odds of the CAQ making a comeback under a new leader are extremely low. But we have one recent precedent of, you know, the federal Liberals doing just that. So it will be very interesting to see who's interested in replacing Monsieur Legault, because it's a very steep hill to climb in public opinion right now.
Let's talk a little bit about the Parti Québécois, an explicitly sovereigntist party, of course, promising another referendum on independence by 2030 if they are elected. Legault's departure, what do you think it means for the possibility of a PQ victory and potentially a referendum if they were to win?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say it changes very little for the Parti Québécois. Right now, they're leading, the PQ is leading among francophone voters. They are projected to win a majority, but there's a strong majority of Quebec voters who are against even holding a referendum, not only just against the sovereignty project, but against holding a referendum. So Monsieur Plamondon will have to juggle this. It will be a very delicate balance that he has to navigate through the next election.
That's the PQ's leader, Paul Saint-Pierre Plamondon. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, as you know, but of course to remind our listeners, the CAQ is, Legault founded it as a nationalist alternative to the Parti Québécois, nationalist but not separatist, this party was going to be. What do you think it will look like without Legault at the helm?
We have an expression for this in Quebec. It's called the third way. So not sovereignty, not full federalism from the Liberals. It was something in the middle. The problem with the Legault CAQ right now is that something in the Legault looks more and more like the Quebec Conservatives, who won no seat in the last election, but still had 13% of the vote. And they seem to be going nowhere right now. They're hovering around 15% of voting intentions. And so if those right-of-center voters decide to leave the CAQ entirely and go to that conservative party, this new third way could be the Conservatives.
Any sense at this stage who Legault's replacement might be?
I cannot answer that, unfortunately, but it's a very interesting question. Whoever decides to throw their, throw themselves in the ring for this, first you have to applaud the courage because it will be a very difficult 7 months before the election, but also you have to wonder whether it's political suicide to go into a party that is so unpopular now and could face an extinction past the next election.
We will see. Philippe, I appreciate this. I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Philippe J. Fournier is the editor-in-chief of the polling website 338 Canada. We reached him in Montreal. It was a momentous, highly anticipated meeting with a lot at stake. It lasted less than an hour. Today, the foreign ministers for Greenland and Denmark had a tête-à-tête with U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. The topic was, of course, the president's stubborn and increasingly hostile threats to take over Greenland by whatever means necessary. Here's how Denmark's foreign minister, Lars Løkke Rasmussen, described the meeting.
It is, of course, very emotional for all of us, and of course, particularly for people living up in Greenland, but also for people in Denmark. And we look at ourselves as U.S. closest allies, and we are eager to fulfill our promises. And even though our view on the situation right now around Greenland differs from public statements in U.S., we share the concerns in a long-time perspective. And we want to work closely with U.S., but it must, of course, be a respectful kind of cooperation.
Denmark's Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen speaking in Washington today. Noah Reddington was a political advisor to a previous Danish prime minister. We reached him in Copenhagen.
Noah, your foreign minister also called this ultimately a constructive meeting, but he conceded in that press conference that they did not change the American government's position. The threat is very much still on the table. Would you say it was constructive in the end, given that?
It was constructive from a Danish and Greenlandic point of view, meaning that now there's a beginning of a process from a diplomatic perspective. You're starting to talk with each other and you're addressing these obvious concerns about security. But as Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen also stated very clearly, they agreed to disagree. And afterwards, in the Danish press conference, the conference in Danish, he stressed three times, and I literally mean three times, he said, "I am not Chamberlain." Really, he was underlining this, "I'm not Chamberlain," because everything is still up in the air.
There was a diplomatic tone we heard certainly there. They're trying to appease the U.S. president's concerns around national security, but also highlighting that, as our other guests on this issue have said, the U.S. had a bigger footprint. They chose to get out, right? They chose to remove that footprint. But do you think being diplomatic with this administration is the right move strategically?
We just don't know, and that's the bottom line. We just don't know what works here. In Europe, there is a discussion about whether or not Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, is he too accommodating, calling Donald Trump Big Daddy and so on. We just don't know how to approach the U.S. But we do know that if the United States really want to take Greenland by power, they can do that just in a fortnight. It would be absolutely no obstacle for the U.S. to do that. And that's really like there is in Denmark, there is a relief about this meeting, but also a concern that we just don't know what really works. And this has been about playing for time to drag out things, and basically just to reach the midterm election in the U.S. and hope that the majority will change on the Hill. But we just don't know what works.
What would the cost be? What kinds of things do you think that they will try to signal to the U.S. or throw at the U.S. that could possibly deter them?
Oh, the cost would definitely be the end of NATO. And that's been the Danish strategy since last week. The Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, she stated very clearly that if the US took Greenland by power, that would be the end of everything. That would really be a very dramatic thing. And also, I think, for the US and also for President Trump, losing NATO would be rather a rather dramatic thing. So Denmark really increased the cost for the US. But you could also say it's a high gamble, especially when it comes to Ukraine, when it comes to the Baltic states. Do they really want to lose NATO in order to support Greenlandic independence and Greenlandic sovereignty?
Do you think that Donald Trump cares if it means the end of NATO?
We just don't know, and that's a frank question. Recently, there was an op-ed in a Danish newspaper said that there should be a special department at our national hospital to accommodate all those people trying to interpret what's going on inside Trump's head, because nobody really knows. Yeah. And I think that's a frank answer.
I've spoken to a couple of Greenlanders on the program recently. Aviaja Fonsein was one of them, and she was describing how worried her family is. She talked about, you know, her mother looking out of their window and the airport is nearby, and she's worried that every time a plane lands that it's American warplanes coming for them. Realistically, is what she is so afraid of, and others, I'm sure, is that a very real possibility?
We just don't know. And I think in the case of Greenland, we need to plan in scenarios. Of course, there's a scenario about, you could call it the Manduro scenario, that the U.S. special troops will fly in over a nuke and just capture the political leadership in Greenland. But the thing is, like, Greenland is such a small community, 56,000 people. Basically, you could just say, put stars and stripes at top and say, now Greenland is part of the U.S., and that would be it. In Denmark, there's a debate about whether or not Danish soldiers, they should fire if approached by American soldiers. And this is a kind of a weird discussion, because we all know if America really want to grab Greenland, they will do that. But we also all know that it's not a very popular idea in America. It's a fantastical scenario that the U.S. would really take Greenland by power. There are many ways that you can take Greenland. You could do it by economic force. You could do it by political pressure. And I think, like, what is like the worst scenario, like the horror scenario, is that security collapses in Europe. And in the aftermath of that, the U.S. will take control of Greenland, just as it did during the Second World War.
So you're not worried?
I'm definitely worried. And I'm definitely worried that I'm definitely worried that Greenlandic politicians, they will try to play this. Right now, there is a gravitation towards Copenhagen. But a half year from now, 1 year from now, there will be a debate in Greenland whether or not they should be part of Denmark or not, or whether they should like gravitate towards North America. Maybe they should have deeper ties to Canada, whatever. And I think that could be a very dangerous situation for the Greenlandic people and its future if it loosens up its ties to Denmark. So we have every reason to worry, but in the short run, meaning like the next year or two, I don't think it's a realistic scenario that the U.S. will like capture Greenland by force.
Noah, thank you for this.
You're welcome.
Noah Reddington was a political advisor to the former Danish prime minister. We reached him in Copenhagen. You grow up, you start to walk and talk, or you start to waddle and bark, and you stop needing your mother's milk. That's just how mammalian life goes. But for some sea lions living on the Galapagos Islands, that is not how it goes. They refuse to let it go that way. A group of researchers have published a paper on sea lions considered super sucklers. who, as that disturbing name suggests, nurse for much longer than expected. Alexandra Childs is a PhD candidate in behavioral and marine biology at Bielefeld University and the lead author on this paper, which was published last month in the journal The American Naturalist. We reached her in Bielefeld, Germany.
Alexandra, I certainly know from my friends who've breastfed their children, it can be really difficult, and a lot of people feel very relieved when that time is over. From what the team has observed, can you get a sense at all of what these sea lion mothers feel about their offspring really milking it like this?
Yeah, the short answer is no. There are occasions when the mums are a bit upset with their offspring for suckling, but the general consensus is that they're quite happy to let them do it. Why, we have no idea.
It's remarkable. Okay, so just to give our listeners a sense, most Galapagos sea lions, when do they generally stop consuming their mother's milk?
Generally speaking, what we found is that they stop. It's quite a large window. It's between 1.5 and 4.5 years. And that's just before they reach sexual, we think they reach sexual maturity. So they start becoming, females can become sexually active at 5 years old. But these guys are carrying on way beyond that threshold.
How long is a super suckler suckling, if you had to put it in human years, just so our listeners can wrap their heads around it?
Yeah, so in human years, so for a sea lion, we expect them to live around 21, 23 years. So if we take that, we make it a bit simpler, we say 20 years, and then we take the average human lifespan at 80, we're looking at individuals who are continuing to nurse into their 20s. Yeah, and the oldest individual that we have seen doing this is 16 years old. So that's someone in their 60s still breastfeeding.
I mean, we're laughing about it. As I told you earlier before we started the interview, that you know, it certainly piqued our interest when this came up as a pitch in our story meeting. Was it hard for you to get your head around all of this?
Yeah, it was actually. I mean, we've had anecdotal accounts of this before, and my supervisor was telling me about when he saw this once. And then we had a year when we were collecting data where we were just seeing it constantly. And you did a double take every time you came across it, and then you went back to the computer, you're like, I've got to check the age again. Am I sure that this is what's happening? Yeah, and it blew our minds.
And what percentage of the Galapagos sea lion population fits in this category of super suckler?
So according to the publication that came out last month, it's a little bit where the thresholds are not quite as stringent. We're looking at I think it was like about 136 individuals within our colony who did this over 20 years. But when we are a bit more strict about the cutoffs, and according to a second study that we are putting through peer review at the moment, we're looking at about 11%.
And you've done field work in the area where these particular sea lions live. What is that environment like?
It's amazing. The wildlife is extraordinary. I mean, I was not a sea lion person before, but I absolutely love this species now. And yeah, it's just incredible to be there and to be living amongst the individuals that you're studying as well. But it's not an easy place to live. These guys, they have a tough life.
The super suckling didn't turn you off.
Well, I signed on before I knew about it. So
now you're in. You know, in the reporting on this in the New York Times, there was reference to the fact that researchers have apparently observed super suckling trains. What is going on?
Yeah, so that was a couple years ago when we first really started paying attention to the behavior. And we had a female who came on the island and gave birth. And she was 6 years old. This was her first pup. We've known her since the mother was born. And they did their mum baby thing, and they loved each other, or if you can say that for a sea lion. They cuddled and they snuggled and the baby got fed, and then a few days later we saw the mum suckling on someone else, and we thought, that's a bit weird. So we double checked, and yeah, it was indeed the mother who'd just given birth, who was nursing on another adult female. And then a few days later we saw the three of them in a row with mum nursing on the older female and the baby nursing on the mum. So we had grandmother, mum, and baby.
There are a lot of words jumping to mind. I'll stick with remarkable because that is accurate also. I know you've looked at decades, 20 years of data for this research. Your team has suggested that this might be about comfort and bonding than food consumption. What do you mean?
So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the conclusions that we came to, or the theories that we are putting out there, just because we can't understand why mothers would continue to allow this, because it's a lot of energy to give away to an offspring who is able to hunt for themselves, and also why the offspring would want to do it, because, you know, they are quite self-sufficient at that age. So it is possible that it's a means of expressing a long-term relationship between the mother and the offspring. But there could also be other reasons that we just don't have the data to check at the moment. They could have immunological benefits to this behavior. That's the big question now, is why they do it.
Have you observed, as you look through that 20 years of data, patterns to this behavior?
Well, contrary to expectations, we actually found that it occurs more frequently during good conditions, so when there's lots of food around, which does make sense, because it means then that the mother is probably not going to put too much strain on herself by providing this added resource to the offspring. But we did anticipate that maybe it was something that was being driven by the offspring in them needing food during bad conditions. So that was an unexpected result, but it was quite interesting all the same.
Alexandra, I appreciate this. I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Alexandra Childs is a PhD candidate in behavioral and marine biology at Bielefeld University. We reached her in Bielefeld, Germany. The one and only two Michelin star restaurant in Wales will serve you the oatest of oat cuisine for a price that is also extremely oat. It costs nearly £500, that's over $900 Canadian, per person. Now, on the plus side, that is for 30 courses, plus an in-house DJ. On the minus side, the place has a one-star hygiene rating. After an inspection, food safety officers gave Ennis here in rural Wales a score of 1 out of 5, meaning major improvements are necessary. Their chief concerns apparently regard the way the restaurant stores and works with raw ingredients. For example, the inspectors were troubled by the sashimi flown in from Japan and the fish aged in a salt chamber. But head chef Gareth Ward says he's getting a raw deal. He says, get it? Yeah. Neil? Says staff at his restaurant are working, quote, at the highest standard in the world, unquote, and that the inspectors just don't get it. Giles Corn is a restaurant critic based in the UK. He told the BBC's Sarah Montague about his recent visit to the restaurant.
He's talking about, it's interesting that you refer to MasterChef, because it's very much not like what you see on MasterChef. It is not kitchens and little pots boiling away and mimsy little things being placed on plates. He is cooking with fire. His kitchen is like Vulcan's smithy. He stands there in his sort of leather apron and it's roaring like fireworks. You're also, conversely, served quite a lot of raw food. He's talking about sushi, Japanese techniques. The cutting edge of sort of Michelin-starred cookery now tends to be lots and lots of fire and lots of Japanese and Southeast Asian raw stuff. So the normal health and safety things, I think it's fair enough we should reply, don't really apply. It's much harder to do. It's not about your fridge and have you put the roast chicken from last night next to the raw chicken, which could lead to, you know, bacteria. It's a different sort of world.
Okay, so if you were to look in his kitchen, would it just appear spotless, and by most measures you'd look at, you'd think this is absolutely fine?
Well, the kitchen is right there in front of you. You are sort of in the kitchen, as you are often in these restaurants, with lots of sort of young, muscular, hairy men throwing things around. They're not foregrounding hygiene. When you arrive, you walk in through the front door, and I stayed the night, you have to. It's a long, long way from pretty much anywhere. As you stand at the counter, they flip open the reception desk, and there is a chiller containing a live lobster and had raw tuna and a bottle of milk, and you go, whoa, you go, and then they hand you a scallop to eat, and you haven't even, you know, you haven't put your suitcase down. So, you know, they are clearly doing enough to prevent the spread of bacteria, but if you imagine a hygiene inspector in his white coat with his pen in his top pocket arriving, expecting to see a neat provincial fridge and seeing that, I can see that he would lose his mind, possibly.
Food critic Giles Corran talking to the BBC's Sarah Montague earlier today.
We are going to take a quick break now. When we come back, the U.S. Department of Justice says there's no reason for it to investigate the killing of Renee Good by an ICE agent. Our guest says that is just one reason. She was right to resign from the DOJ when Donald Trump returned to the White House.
And she stood up by keeping her seat. The late Claudette Colvin was not the cultural icon Rosa Parks became, but by refusing to give up her seat on a bus months before Ms. Parks, she became an early hero of the civil rights era. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thanks for listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Dave the Wave, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. More great music continues at 10 o'clock, Headwaters with Kari Hedlund. And in the 11 o'clock hour, you'll hear a conversation that Malachi Coons had with local musician Charlie Wagner. Support comes from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. And we thank Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. Lake Bemidji State Park offers winter nature art this Monday at 10 a.m. Kids can make masterpieces out of the natural world, and park admission is free for all Minnesota state parks on Monday. We continue with As It Happens on KAXE.
It was 1 week ago today that Renee Good was shot to death by an ICE agent in Minneapolis. And whenever someone is killed by a federal agent in the U.S., the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice investigates. Not this time. Yesterday, Assistant Attorney General Todd Blanche said in a statement that there is, in his words, currently no basis for a criminal civil rights investigation. That cuts out the Civil Rights Division of the DOJ, and with state-level prosecutors also sidelined, that leaves the investigation entirely to the FBI. A wave of high-level resignations of federal prosecutors in Minnesota and the Department of Justice have followed. Stacey Young was a Civil Rights Division attorney with the department for 18 years. She resigned shortly after Donald Trump's second term began last year. She's the founder of the Justice Connection, a network for DOJ alumni.
Stacey, under normal circumstances, if someone was shot dead by a federal agent, an American citizen, as it was in this case, what would prosecutors from the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice have been doing over the past week?
There's a very clear protocol for when something like this happens. What the Civil Rights Division would do is immediately send prosecutors from the division so that they could do a thorough review and open an investigation if such an investigation was called for. That would especially happen if the facts suggest on their face that there was a violation of federal law or the Constitution, and especially if the incident is very high profile and attracts a lot of national attention. All of those ingredients exist here. And what we saw is that the Civil Rights Division told career prosecutors that they were not to go to Minneapolis. And instead, the second in charge at the department said that there is no basis for a criminal civil rights investigation in this case. If you take him at his word, you'd have to assume that he saw a different video than what the rest of us saw. The video seems to indicate that there was misconduct, serious, potentially unconstitutional misconduct by the agent who shot Renee Good. Under any other administration, the obvious thing to do would be to send prosecutors to the scene. Instead, this administration is slamming the victim. It seems to be focusing on the victim's widow and seems to be preparing for a potential prosecution of her. That is alarming. That is nonsensical. So I think we really need to scrutinize everything about what we're seeing in that city right now, and really try to get to the bottom of what's going on here.
The Washington Post and New York Times have been reporting on that, what you were talking about there, that sources inside the DOJ say they were directed to investigate Renee Good's widow. It sounds like you have heard that from people you know who are still inside the department?
It's our understanding that that is indeed what's going on.
I wanted to ask you, Stacey, about your personal decision to resign, to leave the department shortly after Donald Trump took office for his second term. You had served for 18 years, five different administrations. What was it like to make that decision after so much time and under those circumstances?
I took the president and incoming members of his administration seriously when they said that their intention was to put federal employees in trauma. I knew that DOJ employees in particular were going to be under attack because there's only one federal agency that investigated and prosecuted this president, and he made his retributive intentions very clear. It was difficult for me to leave DOJ after spending the vast majority of my career there, but I knew that somebody was going to need to form an organization to provide DOJ with the support that they would need to stay and continue their mission critical work and continue enforcing the rule of law, upholding the rule of law. And I thought that starting such an organization was more important than my trying to stay at the department. And based on what's happened over the last year and the support we've been able to provide to DOJ employees, I'm glad that that's the decision I made. This administration promised to put DOJ employees in trauma, and they have succeeded in that mission. So we have over 100 licensed mental health support, licensed mental health practitioners providing that support to DOJ employees. We provide them with employment support when they get pushed out of the department. We provide them with media support if they leave and want to start speaking out. And we provide them with whistleblower support if they want to expose the lawlessness that we are seeing in DOJ right now. So these are some of the ways in which we are assisting DOJ employees. And without us there, they would be on their own. And public servants enduring what this administration is meting out is unfair. They deserve support, and we are here to provide it.
What kinds of things have they told you?
They've told us that they are being put into situations all the time when they are being given orders to violate the law or violate regulations or DOJ institutional norms or violate the Constitution. That is the kind of thing we are seeing happen in Minneapolis. That is the kind of thing we saw happen with Erez Rivaini, a high-profile whistleblower. That is the kind of thing we are seeing all the time in cases that are not being publicly reported. We are seeing these employees who are needing somewhere to go for help to protect them and to get information out to the public. And we are also seeing employees being denigrated, being called the deep state, being fired for no good reason, being demoted. We are seeing all kinds of previously unimaginable things happening to the public servants who our country used to respect and celebrate. And instead, for some reason, too many Americans are demonizing those who serve our country.
How do you feel about the likelihood that the killing of Renee Good is going to be thoroughly and fairly investigated, and that if a prosecution is, you know, if a case is warranted, that it will come?
I think there is a good chance that this case will be thoroughly investigated and responsibly prosecuted, but I don't think that's going to happen by the federal government. I think if it's going to happen, it will probably happen because of the work by state and local law enforcement.
Stacey, thank you for this, and please take care.
Thank you. You too.
Stacey Young is a former Department of Justice Civil Rights Division attorney and the founder of the Justice Connection, a network for DOJ alumni. In terms of writing advice, write what you know seems pretty cliched. But Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi did that with his new film, It Was Just an Accident, and the result is astonishing. Mr. Panahi has been jailed and interrogated in Iran because of his work, and he channeled those horrifying real-life experiences into a movie about a group of political prisoners contemplating revenge on their presumed interrogator, which he secretly shot in Iran. It won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, has been nominated for 4 Golden Globes, and is expected to be nominated for an Oscar as well. Jafar Panahi spoke to the BBC about the film and what he believes needs to happen in Iran in this current pivotal moment.
What must happen here has to come from within the country and has to be reached by the people themselves. It cannot come from the outside by any political power, but it has to be decided and collectively experienced by the people. Of course, foreign powers might be able to manipulate it, might be able to affect it one way or another, but they cannot do anything that people themselves will not find important and will not reach. This film is the result of my own personal experiences and the experiences of people that I'd heard about in prison. It is only natural that when I left the prison, I would be thinking about them and their stories and their experiences. And the fact that they were still inside prison really affected me to the point that I thought, I need to be unloading this burden that I feel on my shoulders, and I need to be putting this burden down and paying my tribute to them. We could think of cinema as a historical memory, as a historical database that could record everything that's happening right now and could perhaps show it to another situation in another time period.
Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi speaking to the BBC. In 1955, when she was just 15 years old, Claudette Colvin took a stand. She refused to give up her seat on a segregated bus in Montgomery, Alabama, to a white woman. That act of Jim Crow-era defiance came just months before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus. And yet, for decades, Ms. Colvin's name was largely missing from the story of the civil rights movement. Claudette Colvin died yesterday. She was 86. In 2020, she described that moment on the bus to former NPR journalist Michelle Norris.
We was had to get up and give white people the seat, just for, not an elderly woman or an elderly man, just to show that they were superior than and we was inferior. So that day I said, when the bus people asked me, said, "Why didn't you get up when the bus driver asked you to get up?" I said, "You know what? History had me glued to the seat."
Ms. Colvin's courage as a teenager made her a star witness in a landmark anti-segregation suit. And 1 year after her arrest, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that segregation on buses must end. Phil Hoos knew Ms. Colvin well. He's the author of a biography entitled Claudette Colvin, Twice Toward Justice, an in-depth account of her story based on extensive interviews with her. And over the years, they kept in touch and became good friends. We reached Phil Hoos in Portland, Maine.
Philip, you were able to speak with Claudette just a week before she died. What did you talk about?
We sang a lot of the time. Whenever I spoke with her, we would always sing, and she especially liked Hank Williams, Jambalaya and Your Cheatin' Heart. And so we sang Claudette's sister, Gloria, passed us through, and she was, in a hospice situation. She was didn't have much longer to live, but she was joyful in that last conversation, and we sang together. We talked about how lousy the food was at the assisted living facility and how much she missed and yearned for the the yams and so forth that she had as a girl.
What a gift to have that conversation, and what beautiful memories. Thank you so much, Philip, for sharing those with us. And it says a lot about the kind of relationship you built, you know, one that started professionally. You worked for years reporting and writing about her. But initially, she wasn't game. She was hard for you to get in touch with her or to convince her to share her story. What was she reluctant about?
She worked as a medical assistant in a hospital in Manhattan. And she was a union worker, and she didn't want to lose her status with the union or to jeopardize anything from getting her full union benefits. And it took me 4 years to really have a talk with her and ask her if she wanted to have a book about her youthful life and the stands that she took. She had a really quiet life in New York. She hadn't told anybody or much of anybody who she was and what she had done. She wasn't sure anyone would believe her anyway. And so she just waited until the time expired, and it coincided with my ardent courtship of her. I was writing a book about kids in U.S. history. I put together 66 stories, and when I got to the civil rights movement, I kept hearing this one story about this 15-year-old girl who had refused to surrender her seat to a white passenger and who was jailed for it and suffered quite a lot.
Just 15 years old. Our listeners have heard that age a couple of times now, and it's still extraordinary to hear it. I also wanted to ask you, though, after she did say yes, her own family members wondered a little bit why she said yes to you, because you're white. And what did she say to you and them about why she agreed in the end?
There was no marketplace for her. Nobody knew who she was. She had really managed to disappear for decades, 30 years. And so when she retired, that didn't automatically mean that she was ready to tell her story. She wasn't used to talking about herself. But I was, as I say, ardent in my pursuit of her. Finally, after 4 years of trying, every 6 months, I would write her a message, are you ready yet? But I really wanted her to tell her story. And finally, one night I came home from somewhere, and there was a red light beeping on the telephone, and I picked it up, and it was Richard Williams saying, Claudette, we'll talk with you tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness.
Good luck. And that was it. I couldn't believe it, and I stayed up all night writing down questions. 10:30 the next morning, I called her, and she answered the phone, and we got along and had a nice chat. I asked her if I could visit her in New York, and she said yes, and we picked a date, and I flew down. And
I know she told you a lot, but just specifically, again, 15 years old, in that moment, what did she tell you about why she decided to refuse that order from the bus driver?
She was, bored looking out the window, and she became aware that there was a woman, a white woman, standing in the aisle and expecting her to get up, and she just didn't get up. She said she felt, later she said she felt the pressure of Sojourner Truth on one shoulder and Harriet Tubman on the other, and history was causing her to keep her seat.
She was ultimately given a fine and probation. She was convicted in juvenile court. Despite that important decision on that day, and the news, the story certainly gained headlines in Montgomery, civil rights leaders decided not to make her a face of the movement. How did that impact her personally? How did she feel about that?
Well, she was a poor child from a poor family. She lived on the wrong side of the tracks, went to the wrong church, and they sent a committee of women from Alabama State College, And they sort of secretly snuck around and asked Claudette's neighbors what kind of kid she was like. Mm-hmm. And they got the evidence they wanted. It hurt her feelings a great bit, because the black leaders, the adult black leaders, just disappeared when Claudette was found guilty on those three charges. They just dropped her. And she really resented that. That was a really big deal to her.
You became friends. And before we let you go, how will you remember her as a friend? What memory are you holding closest today?
Oh, I'm sad today. I've known this was coming. But when the call finally came, it was really a kick in the stomach. She was incredibly brave to do the things that she did, to let those cops drag her off the bus. I hope that, in coming years, that people will continue knowledge of her and that she'll have the recognition that she deserves.
I hope so too, Philip. I appreciate this. I'm glad we could speak. Thank you, and please take care.
Okay. Take care.
You too.
Philip Hoos is the author of Claudette Colvin, Twice Toward Justice. He's in Portland, Maine. Prime Minister Mark Carney is in China today on a trip where he'll talk trade, security, and agriculture. And Andre Harp does not want him to come home without solid commitments that lead to tangible gains. Mr. Harp is a canola farmer whose business took a major hit after China imposed a 100% duty on canola in 2024. He's also the chair of the Canadian Canola Growers Association. He told the CBC about the challenges he's facing.
We've been closed out now for almost close to 2 years, Canada-wide, we're over $2 billion right now in losses that we know of.
Wow. Walk us through this on your farm. How have you managed? How have you had to adapt?
We have had to sell some canola at reduced prices just because we do need cash flow. We're busy in the middle of planning for next spring already, but I've already had to book my fertilizer. Almost half my farm is canola, and so it means a lot to me.
Yeah. How does that work? Who are you selling it to, and how does that go up the line affected by this, Chinese tariff situation?
Basically, the market actually works off of who's buying what and when. There's not as many people buying. China, they're a $5 billion market. From 2024 to this year, we've lost basically a third of that market. We had a good crop, but because not everybody is buying the way they usually do, there's an oversupply right now.
Yeah. So these tariffs, were rolled out in retaliation to the Canadian tariffs on Chinese EVs. Those tariffs put us in step with what the U.S. is doing, what the European Union is doing. So, when you think about this sort of complex global trade situation, how do you hope the government weighs all this?
All we're saying is we need to open this market up. The Canadian government caused this problem, and I guess what we're asking them is you cause the problem, you fix the problem. But at the same time, it gets back to, we've had good conversations with the Prime Minister. I think he understands where we're at. But farmers cannot continue to take it on the chin for the good of Canada. And if we are, we need to be, the damages that are incurred need to be compensated. I guess we're going to find out how good the conversation has been and how if they're taking our conversations to heart.
That was Andre Harp talking to Lauren McGuinness, host of the Calgary Eye Opener today.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
Good evening. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, and 89.9